Welcome to One True Podcast. My name is Mark Chirino and my producer is Michael Von Cannon. In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence, write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Today's show continues One True Podcast's ongoing project of examining Hemingway's short stories one at a time. We don't do these episodes all the time, so we may get through the first 49 in as long a time as it took Hemingway to write them, but we will get to them all, the masterpieces and the minor efforts alike. But today we discuss the short, happy life of Francis McComber, one of Hemingway's most anthologized stories and one of his greatest. And for this conversation, we welcome Laura Godfrey, a Hemingway scholar who always does interesting work and is an ideal perspective to help us analyze this great story. Laura Godfrey is the assistant chair of the English and Humanities Division at North Idaho College. She has published on a wide variety of writers besides Hemingway. She is the author of Hemingway's Geographies, Intimacy, Materiality, and Memory, the editor of Teaching Hemingway in the Digital Age from the Kent State University Press. And among other works, she contributed essay to the New Hemingway Studies from Cambridge University Press. And of course, Ernest Hemingway and the Geography of Memory, where she wrote a beautiful piece about a different Hemingway short story, The End of Something. Laura, welcome to One True Podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us to talk about the short, happy life of Francis McComber. And maybe we can start for the people who perhaps haven't read it for a long time or haven't thought of it for a long time. Can you give a brief description first of who Hemingway was when he wrote the story and when it came out? Where does it fit into his life and career?
I think all of us Hemingway fans and scholars, we kind of position his stories based on places. And so it's weird, though, with this one, because he's in Key West, having been on his African safari with Pauline in 1933 and 34. He, you know, let some space pass after that safari was over in February of 1934, began writing Green Hills of Africa, which was published, if you think about it, really quickly after that safari was completed. Not a whole lot of digestion time went by between the safari and Green Hills of Africa. And so McComber is a story that he was writing kind of in Key West. He had Pilar. He was doing a lot of deep sea fishing. And it was finished April 19th, I believe is the date I have, of 1936. So it's one of the last African stories before he goes back for another safari with Mary 20 years later. But it's written while he's sort of distancing himself from Africa in that Key West period. So it's, to me, unlike a lot of the stories that he has written, it's nearly technically perfect. It's tightly plotted. It's very well paced. You get more exposition in the story than you get in the early Nick Adams stories. You get more interiority. You get multiple interiorities in this story where, you know, we're able to look through Margot's eyes, through Francis's eyes, through Wilson's eyes, through the lion's perspective. And so in that sense, I think he's beginning, you know, he had done this before, but he's really beginning to loosen up in this story, I think, with letting people inside the minds of characters.
Laura, the same type of technical perfection that you're describing in the story, do you also find that in the other 1936 story, The Snows of Kilimanjaro, which are often viewed in a tandem at this point of his career?
Yeah, honestly, Snows of Kilimanjaro, it was in a graduate seminar that I had on Hemingway back in 1999. So I'm dating myself here in a rather embarrassing way, but I read that story, and Snows of Kilimanjaro is the story that shifted my entire perspective on Hemingway. It allowed me to see into his, I mean, obviously I didn't take it as autobiography, and you shouldn't take McComber as autobiography either. But just being allowed inside in that way, allowed into the interior, into the sort of landscape of the characters' minds, that was a shift. And with McComber, he's really tricky about it because it's all of the access to interiority, I think, through those multiple perspectives that doesn't really let us have sure footing. We have no clear sense of necessarily who's to blame and who's the villain, because we get those competing perspectives. But yeah, I love both of these stories.
Okay, so, and maybe as one other gesture to remind people about the about this story, or to tell them about it if they haven't read it, and they'll use this episode as inspiration to read it, can you give a brief summary of this story? What's it about?
Well, it's about a lot of things. I think plot summary wise, it opens with a sort of awkward, tense post-hunting scene at a safari camp. Francis McComber and his beautiful wife, Margot, are sitting there with their non-native hunter, Robert Wilson, kind of talking around something terrible that has just happened that morning on a lion hunt. Gradually, Hemingway reveals the details of what happened, which is essentially that McComber shot a lion, wounded it, had to track it into the brush. The lion crouched and then charged. And McComber, in his own words, bolted like a rabbit. And in panic, he fled while the lion was charging. And so the non-native hunter, Robert Wilson, had to make the final kill shot. Margot watched all of this. They're horrified. They're ashamed. The narrator tells us that he had just proven himself to be a coward. And so we open with the talking around of the lion issue, the lion incident. And then about, it's like seven pages into the story, the lion incident is fully narrated and we get the full picture from multiple perspectives of what happened, including the lion, which is probably my favorite aspect of the story. And then after the lion incident is relayed, then the story picks back up in real time and the hunt continues. Margot, for whatever reason, sleeps with Robert Wilson, the non-native hunter. McComber at breakfast the next morning is enraged and furious. Something in him shifts and changes. And then they go out on a buffalo hunt and he's in Robert Wilson's words, he's got no bloody fear anymore. The fear is gone. He's shooting. He's hitting. They find three buffalo. They hit them all. They shoot them all. They think they've gotten them all. One runs into the brush, similar kind of echoing the lion incident. They go after it to make the final kill. The buffalo charges. While the buffalo is charging, McComber stands his ground and he shoots straight at the animal coming at him. But as it's about to gore him, Wilson steps to the side, shoots with his enormous gun, and Margot McComber from the car has been watching it all. And she, the narrator tells us, shoots at the buffalo, but for whatever reason, hits McComber in the back of the skull. And at the very end of the story, Wilson is openly blaming her and accusing her of murder because, you know, that's what he says to her. And she's saying, please stop it. And then finally she says, please stop it. And the last line of the story is Wilson saying, that's much better. Please is much better. Something along those lines. So,
all right. That, Laura, that is a masterful summary of it. And you've really opened up this entire discussion with all the things that you mentioned. Why don't we start with the last exchange? And this seems to be like one of those very few Hemingway stories where you really can ask yourself, maybe not who done it, but why done it? You know,
yes.
What can you, how clear does Hemingway make it about the motive of Margot? Because I think you said for whatever reason, well, is there a reason? Is Wilson right in implicating her? What does Hemingway give us at the end of this narrative?
It's the million-dollar question with this story. It's a great question, and I know for anyone listening who teaches this story, that's where the students tend to gravitate when we teach this story. When I first read it, and when I first started teaching it, I saw the story as a kind of a power struggle in a marriage, right? And so I remember being in graduate school and drawing kind of a character line and noticing that Wilson stays static all the way through. He's always who he is, right? He is the character, the hunter that he is and has been made to be. McComber increases his confidence in himself. And so as he rises, you can look at it in the sense that as his confidence increases, Margot's confidence decreases, and possibly interpret the ending in that light. I think that's commonly the way a lot of people have interpreted it. But there's been some recent scholarship. And actually one of the essays in Kevin Myers' collection, Teaching Hemingway in the Natural World, is by, I think his name is Gary Harrington. And he makes an absolutely convincing case that we need to look at Robert Wilson through the context of Hemingway's own beliefs on hunting, his own codes on African safaris and on big game hunting. And that if you look at the details, Robert Wilson is a villain. He's not an ethical hunter. He doesn't treat his native safari support staff respectfully or well. He admits that he illegally lashes them for poor behavior. He, instead of finding them, he admits that chasing the buffalo in that closing scene in a car is also illegal. He sort of treats the women on safaris as, he calls them windfalls. You know, in a sense, he's kind of been trapped in this system, this economic and social system, you know, of being a non-native hunter for these wealthy clients. But if you look at all of the kind of moral complexity to Robert Wilson, and if you look at all of the ethical missteps and lapses of that character, then to trust his blame of Margot at the end, I don't know, it throws it into question for me. Does that make sense?
Very much so. Another facet to Wilson that is interesting is that, of course, Wilson is the consummate hunter, yet he's also kind of admiring about Francis and how, and sort of Francis's evolution as a hunter and as a man, and Francis's own recapturing of assertiveness within his own marriage. And so Hemingway also allows Wilson that type of space to comment on the McComber marriage.
Right, right. Yeah, and Wilson's not through and through an unlikable character. And I have to say that when I read this story long ago, before I knew any of the context or before I'd read the Esquire letters that Hemingway was writing from Africa, where he really clearly delineates, okay, what is sporting and what is just shootism?
Yes.
Before I knew any of that, I just took it at face value that Wilson was a, you know, solid guy. He had some lapses in judgment and morality when it came to his treatment of the staff. But when he quotes Shakespeare to, you know, McComber, when McComber has finally, you know, lost his cowardice in his perspective, I mean, you can see that he had some fine ideals at one time. You know, he's not a villain in a one-dimensional sense in that regard.
And can't you also make the argument that Wilson, by cheating at the end, by using the vehicle, is allowing Francis that moment of redemption, that if he hadn't have done that, there, that Francis never would have had that experience? So I am not exonerating him from sleeping with Margot right under Francis's nose, but there is, I guess, there's that kind of moral ambiguity that we really respond to in Hemingway's work.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, because part of his job in the economic system that he is enmeshed within, part of his job is to get his clients the kill. And he does not get paid unless he produces results. And so you can see, just if you really dig into that aspect of his character, the way that over a series of years or even decades, a person's, you know, system of ethics could start to crumble and erode in those ways to get the job done. And I think it's really masterful the way Hemingway presents that as happening to him without making him seem like this terrible monster on first reading. You know, it takes me multiple readings. It took me multiple readings to see Wilson more as the kind of easier villain to pinpoint in the story. Didn't happen at first.
Are there readings of Margot that can also redeem her? And the reason I say that is because it seems like whenever Hemingway is stereotyped as a misogynist writer or unfriendly to female characters, it seems like these two 1936 stories, The Snows of Kilimanjaro and Short Happy Life of Francis McComber, are the ones that are most frequently cited. So, and Margot herself is used as an example. What about that? Is there moral ambiguity to her too?
Yes, absolutely. And that's the wonderful thing about Hemingway as a writer, is that you can look at face value and see one thing. And then as you start digging in, you see so much more. I think that looking at the characters as people who are in varying degrees, like trapped within these systems that they live within. Margot is, she's not young anymore. You know, if McComber is 35 and handsome and wealthy, he's in a way caught up in his own social stratification and in the rules of the game that he's allowed to play. He's there on a safari to do that because we assume that's what wealthy people do of his set and of his class. Margot appears, you know, as the beautiful trophy wife whose beauty is fading, right? But if you look at some of the things that we know about her, you know, that she used to be able to endorse beauty products that she never used. If you place her within kind of the assigned gender norms and gender roles of 1930s society, she's a lot different. And I don't know that you'd see the misogyny that sometimes people accuse Hemingway of in this story. You see a woman who is constrained within a set of rules and who is pushing back against those rules with some of the only means that she has access to, right? So I think she is as complicated a character to me as Brett Ashley is in The Sun Also Rises, who is also a woman who has access to a very limited amount of power and makes use of what power that she has. You know, their marriage is strained. They're not kind to each other. But the narrator makes a remark in McComber towards the end that, you know, is something along the lines of who they are and who they turned out to be was really no one's fault. And I think that you can see that there's a lot more ambiguity and complexity to the marriage. And it's not just that McComber is this awful sort of husband and Margot is this terrible shrew. Yes, she can be. And she sleeps with someone else on safari while her husband's lying in the next tent. That's not nice. It's not nice to do.
When you refer to Brett Ashley from Sun Also Rises as a nice parallel, that was really interesting because one of the characters I thought of was Francis from The Sun Also Rises. And Francis, and it's almost the same dynamic where the Francis-Robert Cohn relationship is the kind of seesaw that you were talking about. When one is up, the other is down, and there's a power struggle. And you wonder if that is how Hemingway saw relationships, or at least, you know, that there were certain women, or maybe certain men too, who were as awful as they could get away with being. And so as Wilson says, like, oh, she saw an opening.
Right.
And Frances was vulnerable, so she acted in this particular way.
Yeah. Yeah. The Frances character in The Sun Also Rises, not to be confusing with multiple Franceses.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
That scene where she is just ripping into Robert Cohn about being sent off to England and I find that an enormously sympathetic moment when it comes to that character, because she's calling him out on his terrible behavior. She has been used and is being packed away and then shipped off and out of the picture. So, yeah, I think that, you know, the power dynamic of the marriage is part of it, but it's also really good, especially for students who haven't read much Hemingway. It's really good to kind of take the story in its social context, to look at what was expected of people in this social class and in this time and when it comes to gender roles and gender norms, and to see the way that Margot, you know, all those times when Wilson says, well, why don't you order her to stay in camp? Why don't you just make her stay home?
That's right.
And he says, order her. I can't order her to do anything. And then Margot says, let's not have any more ordering. Okay.
That's those, exactly right.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of those moments in there where she is pushing back in the ways that she can and knows how, against this sort of box that she's in.
Do you think of Jane Mason as perhaps the historical inspiration for this character? Is that helpful to think about? Does that add anything to it?
I think in terms of appearance, most of the biographers and the scholars that I've read all note that, yes, Margot McComber's physical appearance is is very clearly drawn from Jane Mason. Jane Mason, you know, just historically from what I've read about her, was just deeply troubled, you know, had a lot of just problems in her life and a lot of difficulties that she was going through in the time that she was friends with Hemingway and with Pauline during those years. And so I don't necessarily see Jane Mason's, you know, mental state as being parallel to Margot Macomber's, you know, because Jane Mason was, she was kind of actively pushing against her own assigned roles in other ways too, but she just, that access, there's not the same sense when I read Margot that she has that deeply troubled aspect to her character.
Yeah. So that leads us back to the last page of Frances Macomber. So the sentence is, Mrs. Macomber in the car had shot at the buffalo with a 6.5 Mannlicher, as it seemed, about to gore Macomber, and it hit her husband about 2 inches up and a little to one side of the base of his skull. So that seems to carry a lot of weight in that, as it seemed to her, as it, you know, so what would a defense lawyer do with that, with that word?
I think a defense lawyer would have a field day with that word. I think, you know, as readers, this narrator, I think, has been described as omniscient yet possibly unreliable by some of the scholarship on this story. Because, you know, when the narrator towards the beginning says Frances Macomber had just publicly proven himself to be a coward, that's not necessarily true. That's a debatable point.
Yes.
Panic is quite different than cowardice. And panic, and even Hemingway talks about this, panic is an instinct that can easily be forgiven. Whereas cowardice, I mean, everyone's afraid in dangerous moments. Everyone, fear is a part of being brave. You have to master your fear in order to be brave. And so I think the narrator says she shot at the buffalo. Some scholars and biographers, you know, like Kenneth Lynn in his biography from the 80s, he takes that as definitive evidence that Margot was innocent. Because the narrator says, well, she wasn't shooting at Macomber. She just shot at the buffalo and she missed. And yes, you can look at it that way. You can also look at it as a story that's put together by a narrator that might not always be spinning the story as an absolute objective truth.
We go a little bit further down in this page and it says, leave it as it is, said Wilson. Go get Abdullah so that he may witness the manner of the accident.
Yep.
And so that, again, there's that word accident. So that's further evidence that this is coming right out of Wilson's. Now, how does he say it? Does he say it dripping with sarcasm? Or, you know, how do you hear him say that word? Is it still, is that legitimate?
I think the way that you would imagine him saying that, because he later goes on to accuse her of murder, would be dripping with disdain and sarcasm, you know, because he then goes on after a little bit farther down the page and he says, well, that was a pretty thing to do. He would have left you too. Right. And so he's right there accusing her of deliberately killing Macomber because his power was ascending.
That's right.
As hers was descending. And so again, it gets back to that point of, okay, well, this is what Wilson thinks. Is this something that I, as a reader, am going to share? Let me go back and look at Wilson throughout the rest of the story to see if that's a safe call.
That's an excellent point. And we have one other opinion on this, and that's Hemingway's own.
Yeah.
Because Hemingway very rarely offered interpretations, but I'm going to read a little bit from his Art of the Short Story, where he says, no, I don't know whether she shot him on purpose any more than you do. I could find out if I asked myself because I invented it, and I could go on right inventing. But you have to know where to stop. Blah, 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 blah. The only hint I could give you is that it is my belief that the incidents of husbands shot accidentally by wives who are bitches and really work at it is very low.
Yep.
So
yeah.
Now, does that clarify it or further complicate it?
Like every Hemingway quote about his own writing, I feel like it further complicates it for me, because I think there was another interview that was quoted in the Harrington article that I mentioned earlier. it was from 1953. And he says something along the lines of Francis's wife shot him because he was a coward, but when he gets his guts back, she's afraid of him. And I think about the description of Big Two-Hearted River here, where he says it was a story about the war without the war in it. Right. And part of me says with Hemingway, okay, this is Hemingway talking about his story. There has to be a certain level of trust and there has to be a certain level of veracity that I assume there. And then the other part of me understands just from reading as much Hemingway as I have that he could shoot off, apologies for the pun, he could shoot off an interpretation or an explanation of a story that he had previously written in various conversations or moments. And it might not necessarily be exactly what he meant. And it sometimes can completely be at odds with other things that he said about the composition of the same story. So,
of course, yes.
Yeah.
No. So that is why we've been debating this story for decades and decades, is because Hemingway didn't give us the answer key.
No.
Right? He just muddied the water a little bit. But what you pointed out before, and I want to just get back to this one last thing about this climactic scene, and that is that Hemingway chooses to end the story not just with McComber's corpse, but with this exchange between Wilson and Margot, and you say, like, she says, stop it, stop it, stop it, and then please stop it. And then it ends on that exchange. Does that tip the balance one way or the other about how we're to interpret that final scene?
For me, it does. And again, my evolution on this story has been pretty significant in the way that I interpret it. When I was younger and knew less about Hemingway and his writing, I purely saw that moment as a moment where Margot had done something horrific and McComber was dead and Wilson was enraged that she had killed him in the prime of his short, happy life. That's one way to look at it. I don't see it that way now because of that complexity to Wilson and just because of the way that the power dynamic in that scene, he is dominating her. He is sort of beating her down with his speech. She is at one point sobbing. She's crying, stop it, stop it, stop it, please stop it. And I think the sympathy for me now in my reading on this story really does lie more with Margot at the end, because of who Wilson has proven himself to be throughout the story. He's static. He remains the same, but he's ethically questionable. And not kind in a lot of different instances. And so his interpretation isn't necessarily the one that I would trust as a reader.
Which makes it all the more interesting that Hemingway ended on that note. You talked about earlier about the theme of courage and panic and cowardice versus courage. One of the discarded titles for the story was The Fear of Courage. And it strikes me that one of the things Hemingway's getting at in the story is that it takes courage to admit that you're afraid of something. Like Tim O'Brien in The Things They Carried, he's like, I was a coward. I went to Vietnam, right? Because he was afraid to say that he was afraid. You don't normally think about it that way, but courage seems to be the predominant themes in Hemingway's work that he examines from so many different perspectives. So is this a legitimate way of determining whether a man has courage? Is this kind of initiation on the hunt, or was it back in the 30s and it's not anymore? What's Hemingway getting at with this dramatization?
I mean, that's a great question because, you know, the Philip Young thesis that, you know, a lot of us have kind of been wrestling with, you know, as teachers and as Hemingway scholars, it was Philip Young who argued that under Wilson's tutelage, McComber was sort of taught the codes of hunting, the ethics of hunting, and he learned courage through this sort of master guide, this master hunter. But again, when we look at the details of Robert Wilson as a hunter, what kind of a moral guide is Francis McComber really receiving here? And so Hemingway, himself in, at various points, he talked about how fear, mastering fear, just kind of managing your fear and recognizing it and moving beyond it, is a part of anything dangerous that you do, right? You're always going to have that fear. It's there. You have to learn to kind of keep it in check and to master it. And so, yeah, a lot of his stories are about managing the fear, controlling the fear, moving beyond the fear, even while it's still there. But I think in this story, you know, what Robert Wilson seems to be urging him to do is to be pushed into this recklessness, where you have no fear. And, you know, the Somali proverb that the narrator mentions, which is that a man is, you know, afraid three times, when it comes to hunting lions. I think that's there for a deliberate reason. I think Hemingway knows that fear is a part of any formula when it comes to courage. There's no such thing as having none of it. And so this story almost to me becomes, yes, you know, in the same way that Margot is locked into her system and pushing against it, and in the same way that Wilson is locked into his, you know, the codes of what a hunter must do for these wealthy clients and he's pushing against it, I think in the same way McComber is pushing against those ideas of what makes a man, what must a man do to be brave? And he recognizes it as just patently ludicrous when he is lying there listening to that lion cough at night in the tent. He's like, I don't want to do this. Why do this? I'm afraid to do this. And so I think that sort of reacting to this odd, very artificial hunter's code, that's part of the story too.
As you mentioned earlier, when Wilson quotes Shakespeare, that quote emerges in Hemingway quite a lot. And Hemingway says in Men at War, that anthology of war writing that he edited, he said that learning that quote was like a talisman. And it made a lot of the fear kind of go. It gave him courage. It allowed him to do that. I guess the follow up to your remarks is, so this story came out in 1936. All these years later, do we look back at this and say this story doesn't really last very well in the sense of, like, in 2021, this isn't really applicable to how we test courage, or does it?
I think that, I mean, when I teach this story to students, I will say that I very rarely teach this in, like, an intro to lit class where this is the only Hemingway that they're going to read. Because I think that it's kind of alienating for students, just as you're saying, to understand this glamorous world of a safari where you really purely are going to collect trophies, and to have this, like, pleasure ritual of the hunt. That's really, even in North Idaho where I live, where people hunt and fish all the time, that's just an alien universe for them to understand. So contextualizing this story, with, you know, students who are going to read a good bit of Hemingway, that's I think really, really important, that this is not the only Hemingway that they see, or that you teach it to them in the context of safaris, of, you know, this type of behavior in the 1930s. The students that I work with test their courage in similar ways, but not by going out and, you know, encountering, you know, large game animals, and chasing them down to shoot them and kill them. It's more, I think, that, you know, extreme snowboarding, extreme skiing, extreme sports, like that's big where I live in the Northwest. But I see my students, when I teach this story, reacting to our discussions about courage and bravery and mastering your fear with the activities that they choose, whatever those might be. And so I think, you know, for me, I learned how to ski late in life when it was 4 years ago, I learned how to ski. And every time I'm at the top of a black diamond, right, that I'm scared to do, that mastery of fear that McComber is going through in this story, like managing it, dealing with it, that's part of it. So I think it can apply to us in those ways.
So it doesn't matter what the activity is, if it's Henry Fleming going to war in the Red Badge of Courage, or if it's killing a lion, or anything that you need to overcome.
Yeah, that seems to be the way my students respond to it. Some of them are deeply afraid of public speaking. Some of them, you know, like really crippling social anxiety. Right. And we talk about that a lot when we talk about this story, that everybody faces their version of this lion at some point. And so Hemingway's asking us to wrestle with what that means, even if the safari is a completely remote and foreign idea to you.
Yeah. When I teach this story in the 21st century, the lion is the most sympathetic character, and nobody wants the lion to die.
No.
Which is, and some of the lovely aspect of the story is that Hemingway shows us the lion's perspective and emotions.
Yep. Yeah. There's a great essay by Ryan Hediger. I think that's how you say his name. In Kevin Meyer's collection, Teaching Hemingway in the Natural World. And he talks about exactly what you're saying, how this, you can really teach this as kind of that post-humanist story where humans are presented not as the dominant member of an ecosystem, but as one member of a complex ecosystem. And by spending as much time as Hemingway does on that lion's interiority and doing it really well, I mean, I am not a creative writer, but I can't even imagine how hard it would be to authentically present a lion's consciousness.
Right.
And the fact that he's able to do that in this story so beautifully and so powerfully, it shows the humans are just another member of this ecology, and it others hit them. It distances them from being the center of the frame.
Yeah, and the lion is the only thing in the story that isn't corrupt, right?
Exactly.
I mean, speaking of corruption, maybe there's one more theme we can touch on that also goes along with the Snows of Kilimanjaro of the same year is the theme of wealth, which I think Hemingway was probably wrestling with a lot at that point in his life. So what is his comment about wealth, and how about I think Wilson might maybe lead us in that direction. What's your reading of that?
I always think when I read this story, I always think of Green Hills of Africa. And in Green Hills of Africa, which just came out the year before this story was published, Hemingway is so conflicted in exactly the same way that you're describing. He understands that he is undertaking and able to undertake a safari, which most people in the world cannot afford. And this was happening in 1933 when times were tough. For a lot of people in America, you know, it was not a time of economic progress by any means. And so the fact that he just seems so conflicted in Green Hills of Africa, and on the one hand, he's glad that, you know, Pauline's uncle Gus funded them and afforded them the money to be able to do this, and he's very appreciative of it. But on the other hand, it's almost like that compressed timeline that they were on. You know, you have a certain amount of money, you have a certain amount of time, you got to get all of these animals, got to get those trophies in. I think he knew that didn't bring out the best in him, you know, just because of that compression and, oh, we only have 3 more days to get the kudu. And so I see that same sense of conflict in Macomber.
Laura, my familiarity with some of your work has been in the digital humanities. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the digital humanities and how this story might lend itself to that kind of work.
Yes. All of that, in terms of the direction that my Hemingway scholarship has taken, it really started when I taught a class a few years ago called Physical and Virtual Environments. And so we were talking about whether or not all of these digital devices sort of fundamentally change the way we live in the world, the way we perceive our physical environments and perceive our senses of self. Hemingway teaches beautifully in this moment because everything he writes, honestly, every single thing he writes, including this story, is a testament to how important it is to be present and to pay close attention. He couldn't have written the stories that he writes had he not paid absolute close attention to the people around him, to the animals around him, to the landscapes around him. And so my students love his work through that lens. He's very much, you know, kind of in keeping with their, you know, their ideas about being present and living intentionally and living fully. And so I think in the context, you know, as far as digital humanities are concerned, you can teach Macomber. I haven't done this yet. I should say this, but it's occurring to me now. You can teach Macomber. You can talk about the title of the story. You can talk about the way that this poor man has lived this fragment of a full life in this very snippet of a second. And you can apply that to Hemingway's overall attitudes about living fully and never regretting that a day was wasted. That speaks really, really clearly to students in this digital generation, in the digital age. They feel that too. They feel that sense of, I have to live. I have to live fully. I have to be fully present and be fully engaged. And I think that's partly, arguably, what this story is about.
So have you used the digital humanities with respect to this work at all in your scholarship?
I have one essay that I published, and it's got to be 9 years ago in the Hemingway Review. And it was a response to an anthology that included Macomber as a story in it. And it was an anthology that was meant to be designed to be visually pleasing to internet generation students. And so what they did, and I think honestly their motives were very honorable, but they inserted a bunch of kind of stock Safari images into Hemingway's text. And I was upset by that because it was being marketed to intro to lit students, basically. And I think the entire way that Hemingway has arranged this story and very carefully plotted this story is so as not for us to see the lion immediately. They talk around the lion. The lion doesn't come until the center of the story. But in this particular anthology, there were very direct, bold images of lions and safari helmets and even like a tumbler of whiskey with ice, which, you know, ice would have been miraculous on safari in the 1930s. So
no machines or, yeah, right.
Right. And so that's what kind of led me in that direction, is for editors of an anthology to take this story and to try to make it more palatable for digital age readers, so-called internet generation readers, by putting pictures in, when Hemingway very clearly doesn't want us to be othering the lion, especially in that way. He doesn't want us to be looking at this animal as this, oh, there's a stock safari lion. He wants us to get inside that lion's mind and feel what it is feeling. And you can't really do that if you're looking at, you know, something that quite frankly reminded me of like Simba in The Lion King. It took something that was very specific and very moving in the story, and it watered it down.
Yeah. You mentioned the title, and maybe we can end on that note since we talked around it, but haven't really figured out what Hemingway is getting at with the title. This was one of the stories that he used. He tried out many titles, and then he happened upon The Short Happy Life of Francis Macomber. So what is your interpretation of the title?
Again, conflicted, and it has evolved over the years. You know, I think that in the original way that I interpreted this story, I more fell into the camp of, oh, he lived briefly. Briefly he lived fully. Briefly he lived completely. Briefly he lived bravely. Thus the title. And I think now I can still see it that way, but I can also see it as a title that reminds us, again, that I think all of these characters, including the lion, honestly, these characters are boxed in and they're constrained and they're pushing against those limitations on them, and they're pushing against the rules that guide them and that bind them in the decisions that they make. And the title reminds me of that. It reminds me of that for Francis. It reminds me of that, honestly, for Margot. Less so for Wilson. So I have evolved, and sometimes I argue with myself about what I think of the title.
Well, the title gets you to do that, right? Think of it in different ways. Is there a sense that the story is a coming of age story, that you can be 35 years old? And I mean, this is something Wilson even talks about. So 35, the biblical midway point, right? Dante's age.
Right.
And he has a kind of a conversion, even if it doesn't last but a couple of minutes, right? It's enough. In literature, that's enough. So maybe that's something that Hemingway's celebrating?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, I think Wilson calls the type, you know, Francis Macomber's type is those American boy men, and they retain their baby faces well into middle age. You know, that is obviously there in the story, that he has not grown up. With all of his wealth, with all of his money, with all of the things he's able to do, he's never really been tested. And so I think you're absolutely right. The title speaks directly to that too.
That is such a great detail that his appearance is that of an overgrown boy.
Yeah.
And then it says, as you mentioned earlier, it's Wilson who comments on this coming of age, right? More of a change than any loss of virginity, fear gone like an operation, something else grew in its place. Main thing a man had made him into a man. Women knew it too. No bloody fear. So that kind of staccato description of the new man, right? That which is another rejected title, the new man of Francis McCumber. Maybe, Laura, the thing we can end on is one more time to think of the Snows of Kilimanjaro and Francis McCumber next to each other, since they're often viewed as a tandem. Is there something about the Snows of Kilimanjaro that is more digestible or more universal or easier for 21st century readers to absorb than this story? Our conversation is making me think about this again in juxtaposing those two stories. Why do we talk about the Snows of Kilimanjaro more than we talk about Francis McCumber?
That's a great question. It's hard to think about teaching these stories by themselves. And always for me, it comes back to how would I teach this story? How would I teach these stories in a way that did justice to Hemingway and moved beyond the stereotypes? I mean, I think for any author that I teach, whether it's Hemingway or Emily Dickinson or any of those authors that have sort of accrued that layer of mythology around them, that's not necessarily useful. And when it comes to analysis, Jane Austen, Emily Bronte, Willa Cather, Hemingway, I think both of these stories are very difficult to teach for beginning literature students who don't know a lot about Hemingway, because the danger is that they come away assuming some of the stereotypes that maybe they've had exposed to, right? And so what you can do really beautifully by pairing these stories together is to help students pay attention to the complexity with the way that he arranges the relationships. Yes, these characters say terrible things to each other. The dying writer in Snows of Kilimanjaro calls his wife a rich bitch and he insults her. But at the same time, you can get glimpses of real compassion in that marriage and real connection in that marriage. It's the same thing with McCumber. I mean, that line from the narrator that who they are and how they came to be this way was really no one person's fault or something along those lines. Hemingway, the myth, is very different from Hemingway, the writer. And so I think these two stories working together can combat some of those assumptions that we have in really, really good ways, productive ways for students.
Laura Godfrey, thank you so much for your brilliant insight on The Short Happy Life of Francis McCumber. This was great.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. This was really fun.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode is available on HemingwaySociety.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at OneTruePod. That's the number 1TruePod. Or email us at OneTruePod@gmail.com. Our show is supported by the Hemingway Society, the English Department of the University of Evansville, and Florida Gulf Coast University. Join us next time as we continue exploring Hemingway, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon, and this is One True Podcast. Oh,